A number of years ago, before it was too dangerous to do so, I would occasionally pick up a hitchhiker. And I picked up this young fellow one day. I was on my way down to Pensacola for an engagement. At one time in my life, I felt a moral responsibility to try to enthuse, inspire, motivate, invigorate, educate every human being I came in touch with. Well, I've obviously got a captive audience in this particular instance. The young man could not go anywhere. He was tied down. There he was. And so as we chatted along, you know, and I started espousing my philosophy of life and how wonderful things were, you know, and finally I finished my little dissertation. It didn't take me nearly as long in those days as it does now. And I got through and I said, well, son, let me ask you. I've been doing all the talking. I said, how would you like to make a lot of money and be really successful in life? He got that faraway look in his eyes and a wistful expression came on his face as he said, oh, I wouldn't mind. Well, now, that's not exactly what I had in mind. I mean, now, that's not the way I would describe an overwhelming desire for being successful. You can check the records. You'll find that great teachers, brilliant musicians, outstanding athletes, marvelous parents, unusually effective government leaders, all of them have had a tremendous desire to be successful in whatever it is they're doing. Whether it's to be the best household executive, the best parent, or the best banker, it requires a considerable amount of desire in order to get there. A 1986 Harvard study revealed that the outstanding people have one thing in common, and that is an absolute sense of mission. They don't go to work every day. They go on a mission. They have something they really want to do. I believe that desire is the great equalizer. You know, in the old West, they used to have the six-shooters, and that way the little feller could handle the big feller. And that was their equalizer. In today's world, I believe that the equalizer is desire. If we use enough of it, and if we have enough of it, it will enable us to change the hot water of mediocrity to the steam of outstanding success. You know, little things do make a big difference. You take 211 degrees and you've got really hot water. You can take that hot water and you can make a cup of coffee with it or a cup of hot tea or you can shave with it. But if you add one more degree and then that hot water converts to steam, you can take that steam and propel a locomotive literally all over the country. Or you can take a steamship and propel it all the way around the world. It's the other degree that makes the difference. Most salespeople will tell you there is absolutely no commission on the sale they almost make. How many of you are salespeople and would agree with that? There's not much excitement in almost sinking the putt or almost getting a hit or almost anything. But the difference between doing it and not doing it many times is measured just in minute amounts. When I think of desire, I think of a baseball player who back in 1946 played for the St. Louis Browns. Now, the St. Louis Browns were arguably the weakest major league team to ever take the field. Their one loss record was three shades worse than pathetic. This baseball player they had only lasted 1 year. He was an outfielder. He was not even a regular. He never got a home run. And yet I believe that for my money, he's got to qualify as a legitimate candidate for the Hall of Fame. The young man's name was Pete Gray. And as a young man, he'd had a burning desire, an absolutely overwhelming ambition, and that ambition was to play Major League Ball. And he did it despite the fact that he only had one arm. But that one arm, coupled with a tremendous desire, enabled him to get all the way to the major leagues. So many times it is the thing that does make the difference. I have a friend and an outstanding speaker from Charlotte, North Carolina. His name is Ty Boyd. And Ty often says that you take the hand you're dealt and utilize it to the best of your ability. And with that combination, you are going to, in fact, be successful in many, many fields of endeavor. Now, a lot of people complain today about not having enough talent to do the job. How many times have you heard somebody say, boy, if I could whistle like that fella, or sing like that fella, if I could recruit like that one, or sell like that one, or handle objections like that one, or manage like that one? What they often are saying is, if I just had somebody else's ability, what wouldn't I do? The answer is not a cotton-picking thing. With somebody else's ability, if you're not using the ability which you have. One of the best-known parables is the story of the talents. It seems that the Lord was going away into a far country, so he called three of his servants in, and he gave one of them 5 talents, he gave one of them 2 talents, and he gave the third one 1 talent. He says, now, I'm going to be going away into the far country. When I come back, I will expect a report on what you do. Well, when he came back, he called the one he'd given 5 talents to, and he said, well, how'd you do? And he said, well, Lord, he said, I really did good. I took these 5 talents, I put them to work, and now I've got 10. The Lord said, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Because you've been faithful in few, I will give you many. And so he gave him more talents. And then he said some exciting words. He says, enter ye into the joy of the Lord. He went to the second one and said, how'd you do? And he said, well, I did good. He said, I had the 2 talents. I put them to work. Now I got 4. He says, you did do good. And he told him the same thing. He went to the one who had the 1 talent. And he said, well, how'd you do? And now, you know, we're going to get a different answer, aren't we? Now we encounter one of the crybabies of life. Those who always say, you know, if I'd have just had more, I'd have used what I had. And he said those prophetic words, you know, Lord, I knew that you were a hard and cruel master, but you reaped where you did not sow. And I knew that you were unfair and unjust. And so I took the 1 talent you gave me and I buried it, and here it is. And then what the Lord said were the hardest words you will find in that portion of the Bible. Thou wicked and slothful servant. And he took the 1 talent away from him. Now, you understand that what I'm now going to say is pure conjecture. I have no reason whatever for believing this. And yet it just seems to me that it is consistent with everything I know about life. I believe had the dude taken the 1 talent and tried to do something with it, that even had he lost it, I believe he would have been given another chance. I really believe that. But because he did not use it, then it too was taken away from him. The law says very clearly that if we use what we've got, we will be given more to use. When we were doing our section on goals, I talked a great deal about the fact that we identify a lot of things that we think we want. We write them all down. Now, I said it might work out that you don't want to work on those right now, but don't eliminate those from the list, because later as you grow and mature and develop, then they will become legitimate goals at some other area of your life. When we grow, we can do so many more things with the talent which we have. Newt Rockne, the famous football coach at Notre Dame, had a statement. He said, I don't like to lose, and that isn't so much because it's just a football game, but because the defeat means the failure to reach an objective. I think that's a pretty good way of looking at it. When you use what you've got, when you have that desire, the chances of winning, though, are much, much greater. Right, and you pointed out that a lot of people thought they had to be either good losers or bad winners. He felt this was a lousy choice. He also pointed out that he had no desire to get enough experience at losing to be a good one. Show me a good loser, he said, and I'll show you a loser. Give me 11 lousy losers, and I'll give you a national championship football team. He said, the way a man wins shows much of his character, and the way he loses shows all of it. However, I'm speaking about the will, determination, and the desire to win. We simply don't have to make the choice between being good losers and bad winners. We can be good winners, and the more experience we have at winning, then the better we can become or get at being good winners. When I think of desire, I think of a man named Ben Hogan. Now, I'm a golf bug or a golf fanatic. There are a lot of people who play the game better than I do. There really are, as you would undoubtedly know. But I don't believe there's a human being alive who enjoys the game anymore. I just love to get out there and tee that little dude up. I run a temperature when I get close to the golf course. I really do. So when I start talking about golfers, I start talking about Ben Hogan, who might well be the greatest player who ever played the game when you consider everything. He started on a financial shoestring, literally had to eat almost nothing and survive in the cheapest places to survive the tour. And then just as he was reaching his peak, one night he and his wife Valerie were on their way to another tournament. It was very, very foggy, and as they rounded a curve, he saw the oncoming headlights of a Greyhound bus. He instinctively and instantaneously threw himself over in front of his wife, and that move probably saved both of their lives because his steering wheel was jammed all the way back through the seat where he was. The doctors, and there were many of them, were unanimous in their agreement on one thing, and that is that Ben Hogan would be a very, very fortunate man to ever get out of his bed. They all knew he'd never be able to walk, and as far as him ever playing the game again, it would be out of the question. There was no way. But they simply had not reckoned with the steel will, the tremendous drive, the outstanding desire that Ben Hogan had. And even as he lay there in the hospital bed, he had those golf clubs in his hands. And he kept feeling those clubs and visualizing those clubs. And he started doing exercises to strengthen his hands. When he started walking again, he could just barely, with the aid of canes and crutches, just barely move around. But he would stand there in his room, and he would take his putter, and he would start putting. He would go out to the course on crutches, and he would stand there, and he would swing, just standing there, swing a club, and swing a club, and swing a club. And gradually, over the months, he got stronger and stronger. And, of course, the rest of his story is absolute history. He won those tournaments. He set some records. He did some things that were absolutely impossible. Ben Hogan was not what you might call the natural golfer. His was a talent that was there. There's no denying he had some. But there were many golfers who had infinitely more. But nobody had any more desire to make it than Ben Hogan did. Now, lest we misunderstand, a lot of times, you know, we kind of get carried away. And I have a natural tendency to do that. My enthusiasm sometimes, you know, gets the best of me. And enthusiasm is kind of like running in the dark. You know, you might get there, but you might get killed on the way. So enthusiasm sometimes has to be tempered with direction, and I try to do that. Because sometimes people get the impression that all you've got to do is have the desire, and then you can do just about anything. And that oftentimes is not quite the case. In the 1988 Olympics in Calgary, Canada, I think all of us who have any interest in sports are aware of the fact there was a young man named Dan Jansen who was our speed skater. He was favored to win a gold medal. Surely 90% of the people in the world, with the exception of those who were competing directly with him, whose country was competing directly with him, with that exception, I believe everybody else in the world was pulling for Dan Jansen. That very morning, his older sister had died of leukemia. His desire to win that medal was absolutely overwhelming. He had trained faithfully. He was favored to win. And yet on the very first turn, as one of those quirks of fate happened, his skates flew out from under him, and he goes crashing in the wall, and he ends up being out of the race before it even got started. It took a tremendous amount of desire to get him where he was. But let me say that what happens now, his desire to do something with that accident is going to be a determining factor in what he really does with the rest of his life. How will he handle that one? Is the same desire going to be there? And I'm not necessarily talking about him preparing another 4 years to be a skating champion again, but I'm talking about what's he going to do with his life. See, each one of us in our lifetime have faced some serious disappointments and some defeats and some setbacks. We're going to face them again in our life. And so what we're going to have to do is learn how to handle those situations like that. But again, let me say that desire creates what we call intelligent ignorance. And if you've got some real intelligent ignorance, then a lot of things can happen. For example, in the world of sales, we have seen this happen where a brand new salesperson comes in. This individual really does not understand all of the fine techniques of selling, but they're so gung-ho on the product and they're really enthusiastic about it. They believe it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and they just believe that for them this represents a tremendous opportunity. They believe everybody alive ought to have this fantastic product, and the net result is they go out and sell rings around the old established pros. How many of you have seen that happen time and time again? Desire does make a difference in many occasions. Desire also has manifested itself a lot of times in basketball games and football games, where you've had the players out there a few minutes, and then the coach blows the whistle, or the ref blows the whistle, and the coach said, substitution, and off comes a fresh body off the bench, you know. Here's a second stringer, but here's one who wants to really impress the coach and the crowd, you know, and if I'm going to get out there, and I'm really going to show him a thing or two, and who knows, maybe I will be starting the next game. And I have seen the substitute in many occasions actually perform better than the starting player. They have that little extra little bit in there that makes a difference. The bumblebee, I believe, is the classic example of what intelligent ignorance is really all about. If you've done any reading and studying about aerodynamics, you know that the bumblebee cannot fly. His body is too heavy. His wings are too light. We read very carefully and clearly that it is impossible for him to fly. But you see, the bumblebee doesn't read. The bumblebee flies. Henry Ford was a classic case of a man who had what we call intelligent ignorance. He was a man with a limited education. He had made a fortune with the old Model T and then the Model A. And then one day he had a wild idea. I mean, weird and way out. He conceived an idea of building a V8 engine. Now, Mr. Ford was not an engineer, so he called his high-priced staff together and he said, gentlemen, I want you to build for me a V8 engine. Well, they tried to humor the old man a little bit. You know, they didn't want to put him down too hard, but they gently explained to him that the V8 was an engineering impossibility. And he said, well, I understand that, but we've got to have one, and I want you to build it, and I want you to go do it right now. Well, they made a half-hearted effort. They spent quite a few dollars. They came back a few months later and said, well, Mr. Ford, just like we said, the V8 engine is an impossibility. It cannot be done. He said, gentlemen, obviously you don't understand. We've got to have a V8 engine, and you're going to build one. Now go build it. Well, this time they went out and they spent a little more money. They stayed a little bit longer. And finally, they came back and said, Mr. Ford, it just can't be done. Well, this time, Mr. Ford really hit the ceiling. I mean, he blew his stack. He said, gentlemen, apparently I'm not communicating my message to you. The V8 engine is going to be built, and you're going to build it for me, and I want you to go out there this time, and I don't want you to come back until you tell me the news we've got to have. You are, in fact, going to build a V8 engine. They built the V8 engine. One man had that intelligent ignorance, and that really is what happened. Henry Ford once said, I'm looking for a lot of men with an infinite capacity for not knowing what can't be done. That's what all of us need in every company in America. We need more people who don't know what can't be done, and they're the ones who will go out there and do it. I love what our Mrs. Mamie McCullough, the I Can lady, says. She's the one who's taken the book, See You at the Top, and converted it to a course which is being taught all over the country. She, in teaching her first class down in the little town of Thomasville, Georgia, thought of this one day and has had a tremendous amount of fun with it. And the nice thing about it is it makes a lot of sense. First day, she said to the class, I want you to describe for me an I can't. She asked them to describe it to the very best of their ability. What does a can't look like? And they wrestled with that a moment or two and said, well, Mr. McCullough, we don't know what a can't looks like. She said, I don't either. She said, now I would like for you to describe for me a can. And they started describing cans, you know, big cans, little cans, or round cans, square cans, long cans, short cans. I mean, all kind of cans. She said, in other words, there's no such thing as a can't. You can't see it and smell it and taste it and feel it or touch it, but you can smell, feel, taste, touch, can. So I can't doesn't exist, but I can does. We're going to call this the I Can course. And I believe that that is what we need more spirit like in this country of ours, the I Can spirit. See, if you take intelligent ignorance and lemon and you end up with lemonade. During World War II, General Creighton Abrams, during the Battle of the Bulge, was completely surrounded by the enemy forces. They were north, south, east, and west. His staff officers came to him in a panic and said, "General Abrams, we are completely surrounded." And he, in essence, said, "Well, that's magnificent. Let's let the troops know that for the first time in the history of this entire campaign, we can now attack the enemy in any direction we choose." It's not what the situation is, it is what we make of the situation we're in. We just need to remember that the darkest night since the beginning of time did not turn out all the stars. And that on the brightest day, you can go down into a well and you can see the stars only from the dark spot. Sometimes when things look their very darkest, it is only at that darkest moment that we can, from the well, see the gleam of light that is going to lead us to where we really want to go. But we've got to have that desire in order to do that.